So yeah, how you doing in the? How you coping in the bunker?
It doesn't seem that much different to how it normally works.
A lot of people are saying that.
Yeah.
A lot of people are saying that. I mean, I've, you know, one of my nephews says that basically, you know, he's living his best life at the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. He doesn't have to go out. He's not, you know. He claims to be not particularly sociable, so he says, you know, I just get up when I feel like it. I hang around at home, listen to music, play games, eat donuts. He says, I'm all good.
Yeah.
So I think it appeals to some people.
Yeah, and having to work from home and being within the family in the same room as I'm working, which is fine, but I really like to separate that. Like work is for work and home is for home.
Yeah.
And the two clash together is, I don't like that.
Yeah. I find being in the same head to work often a bit difficult.
Ah, yes.
You know what I mean? Because you're there in your head, but it's rented out to a whole bunch of other voices as well. So you're sat there trying to get the work done. And then another part of you is saying, oh, you know, what are you going to have for tea tonight? You're thinking, oh, I'm actually rather more interested in that than what I'm thinking about. And then another voice will say, yeah, but there's this particular problem you've been trying to crack in a computer game. I think I know how to do it now. Oh, yeah, that guy. And you can generally avoid those voices if you don't, if there's no opportunity to act on their advice.
Yes.
Whereas I find now I'm at home, all these voices in my head are just saying, look, it's right over there. It's right over there. The kitchen's just there. Go and have some biscuits. No, really. You know, your Xbox is just there. You could just go and play with that now.
I really want, please, God, give me a distraction from this really boring work I've got to do. And, my daughter says, oh, can you help me with this piece of homework? Yep, brilliant. What a perfect excuse.
Yeah, gonna iron your socks. that's a vital thing.
Yeah.
So anyway, so your time has come. And we've all been waiting for it. We knew it was coming.
Yeah.
And now it's here. Wittgenstein, right?
Never heard of him.
Yeah. I mean, that would be great, wouldn't it? And we do a session. We do actually do a session on Wittgenstein where you don't actually mention his name.
I'll try.
Which is great, yeah. Which would be quite be interesting from a Wittgensteinian point of view, really, whether or not you need the name of the guy to be able to speak authentically about the guy, or to speak about his ideas.
What I found was, I think, as you mentioned before, when we were going into the kind of areas that you were kind of fond of, or the stuff you actively studied. I found myself thinking about what kind of questions may have been asked of me, or what I should say, and I started a little bit of a panic. You know, it's like I used to know this. You know, could reel it off, yeah. And suddenly I find myself, oh God, I've got to go back. And I realised that it is, particularly with the person we're talking about.
You're going to do this.
It's like. With him, it's like you're preparing for a marathon, and you've got to train every day, and particularly reading his stuff. The later stuff is, in a way, is easier, but in another way, it's harder. But particularly the Tractatus, to really come at the Tractatus, you need to have get yourself in training. You need to know exactly what you're dealing with, because it's really, really, anyone who's not had any kind of training in Wittgenstein, open the Tractatus, they're going to not last one page. It's not because they're not clever. It's because it's just full of stuff that's references from other things. You know, there's lots of logical language in that. Yeah, go on.
I mean, there are some nice, eminently quotable, kind of pithy phrases, sentences. And unlike Nietzsche, I suppose, who also has lots of quotable, pithy sentences.
Yeah.
These are not, and I don't want to upset Nesso or anybody who's, I don't want to denigrate Nietzsche, but I mean, Nietzsche's language was much more kind of flowery. It was much more artistic. There was more playfulness in it. and so on. Whereas, and so, you know, you can quote a Nietzsche sentence.
Yeah.
And it could be unpacked in all manner of exciting ways, depending on your mood or what you had for lunch or whatever. Mm. Whereas Wittgenstein didn't want to do that, did he? I mean, his sentences, his phrases, were supposed to be clinical. They were supposed to be surgical sentences to sort of say, this, you know, the world is everything. You know, the world is everything. That is the case. You know,
yeah.
That is not open to interpretation. There's no, you know, artistic let about that. It's kind of, he had a specific thing in mind.
Well, with Wittgenstein, he's coming from a kind of a culture of new way of looking at the world, and which weirdly you can link with architecture. So modernist architecture.
Because he was an architect for a while, wasn't he?
I mean, he did. Yeah, actually,
he kind of in the middle point
of his life, he gave up philosophy, and just thought he'd become an architect, and he designed and helped build. I think it's called House of Wittgenstein. I said his name.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah. But, it's like his sister-in-law's house.
That's right. Yeah, and it's modernist. So it's lots of clean lines, lots of straight lines, doing away with any kind of decoration. You know, architraves out. You know, this kind of thing. And he looks at language the same way.
Didn't he famous? I mean, just on the architecture, just to get a sense of the guy's head. Didn't he famously get really pissed off with the height of the ceilings?
Yes.
And decided he wanted to heighten the ceiling by, like, you know, 3 centimeters or something like that. And because for him that just kind of cut it. And that just seems to me to kind of sum the guy up really.
Yeah, you can imagine lots of builders kind of hanging around.
Oh, well,
I like to think of the English builders, but obviously they were hanging around smoking fags.
Yeah,
he's here again.
Here we go. Yeah.
What's next?
Oh, come on, Ludwig. It's crazy Ludwig back again.
So I think there are lots of influences on Wittgenstein that you can like trace back to different areas of his thought, and I think one of them was Krauss, Karl Krauss, which would be a kind of a we'd always also think of Orwell. So he's really was interested in making precision of language. So the Tractatus is presented boiled down to the umpteenth. It's got to be not misinterpreted in such a to extent that everything's cut away from it, which of course makes it difficult. To really understand in lots of ways.
I mean, it's only about, what, 50-odd pages?
Yes. I think it's, off the top of my head, I think it's about 60 pages.
Right,
60,
yeah.
70 pages. But he's...
but not a wasted word.
There is definitely not a wasted word. So, I don't know, how should we go about this? How in depth should we want to go here?
Well, I mean, it'd be interesting to put him in his context a little bit. I mean, again, it'd be great to hear what you say. I mean, he wasn't, strictly speaking, as I understand it, part of the Vienna Circle. I mean, he never turned up to their kind of like their meetings or anything, but he was influenced by them and influenced them.
What was his relationship to
the Vienna Circle, do you think?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, maybe... They come a little bit later. They come after the Tractatus was written, and they were totally influenced by him. And I guess what we should do is maybe we talk a little bit about Russell and them. So a little bit about Russell, really quickly. So Russell was influenced by Gottlob Frege. So they brought about this kind of new way of looking at logic. So before them, logic was Aristotelian, so it's very basic logic. I think we all know it, all men are mortal, and Socrates is a man, blah, blah, blah. So what they wanted to do is they wanted to kind of make that more more intricate, more useful, more in-depth. And they kind of looked at the basis of mathematics. Which is weird because when you first read it, you think, you can't get more foundational than mathematics. But actually, it goes underneath mathematics and more logic. Long story short, they run into some problems because they come up with these paradoxes, which we know in philosophy there's lots of paradoxes around. You know, the sentence "I am a liar," is a paradox because you can't say a lie if you're a liar. So there's something similar within their philosophy, and it was in a kind of a bit of a panic. What are we going to do about this paradox in this logic? So Russell came up with a quick fix. Literally come up with a quick fix. So to take the problem of the paradox of the logic, we come up with this idea. It's to do with set theory. We won't go into that, but he came up with this idea, and that's where Wittgenstein comes in. Mm-hmm. So Wittgenstein's background, he was an engineer. Mm. So he studied engineering, and then from engineering he went to mathematics. The basis of engineering is mathematics, and then the basis of mathematics, logic, Russell and Frege, and then, of course, philosophy. So he comes in kind of taking up the cause from Russell, because Russell's kind of exhausted. He's written this book on mathematics, and he's done this quick fix for this paradox, and Wittgenstein points out the problems with it.
Mm.
So
that went down well.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the relationship is really interesting. So if any of our listeners have time to go into that, it's very interesting because, Wittgenstein was a rich boy. He was the son of one of the richest people in Europe.
Yeah.
And when he would do things like if he wanted to go on a holiday somewhere and there were no trains running, he would buy a train, rent a train. Just for himself.
But I mean, you've been known to do that, right?
Well, on occasion.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, Russell's, I mean, and this perhaps this speaks to what we've said in the past, that in some respects, philosophy can be seen as a bit of a privileged pastime. Because, I mean, Russell as well was from an aristocratic background. These people were not short of a few bob. Mm. And that gave them a sense of security, which then allowed them to think about these great questions. It's not suggesting for a moment that necessarily that they were taking advantage or whatever. I mean, we know that. I mean, Russell was very, very kind of politically active, and got locked away for his beliefs. For his pacifist beliefs, for his anti-war beliefs, for his anti kind of nuclear stuff and so on, and was quite often getting locked up. Nevertheless, these people were not short of a quid or two.
Exactly. I could kind of give them...
Didn't Wittgenstein give a lot of his money away?
Yeah. So after writing the Tractatus... So I think maybe... Yeah, we'll go back a little bit. So meeting Russell. So one of the things about Wittgenstein is that also, apart from being from a rich family, all his family were geniuses. They're composers they're also like very kind of serious. I think two of his brothers committed suicide, and his remaining brother lost an arm during the war and stuff like this. And to cap it all, Wittgenstein kind of took up this ideology that he got from this guy called I can't remember the name now. I'll have to come back to that one. Mm-hmm. But he was this kind of mad guy who was who had this. It's like a misogynist. He was Jewish, but he was anti-Semitic, and he wrote this horrible book about your kind of innate wrongness of women and Jewish people, even though he was Jewish. And you think, well, why did Wittgenstein like this? But the part of the writing that in it was to do with it's your duty. If you have any kind of ability, you must use it. Mm. So Wittgenstein was kind of fired up with this. So he and with his brothers committing suicide and this, that, and the other, he was continually thinking about if he doesn't do something good with his life, he's going to kill himself. And he would say it to everybody.
Yeah.
So he'd say it to he said it famously to Russell. Am I an idiot? If I'm an idiot, I'm going to go and do engineering or kill myself or whatever. If I'm not, then I'm going to write philosophy.
We suddenly alienated, all our engineering listeners. So if I'm an idiot, I'm just going to become an engineer.
Exactly. Oh, there's so much to talk about Wittgenstein. Maybe we should cut some of it. But,
I mean, what's interesting, I mean, what I found, I mean, from a lame person's point of view, because again, this is not an area that I have any detailed background in, unlike yourself. But just as a kind of a background thing, thinking about it, it's very easy to kind of come at people like Russell and Wittgenstein, for example, who are very, very, they were very logical philosophers, who were very concerned with mathematics. It was a very precise, almost pernickety kind of philosophy, such that, and this is the sort of philosophy that I think people find most impenetrable. This is not like your continentals, which are talking about life, the universe, and everything. This is talking about the kind of minutiae of language and the logical connection between language and its relationship to mathematics and all that kind of stuff. And in some cases, it's almost, I mean, unless you've got a maths background, you probably aren't going to get most of what they're saying in some of their works. And yet, for all of that, as far as I can tell, both Russell and Wittgenstein were deeply concerned with trying to make philosophy relevant to everyday living. I mean, it's almost like, and we've been talking about the phenomenologists and about how they were thinking, okay, you know, what we want is we want kind of philosophy that will unpack the world, unpack my world, help me understand my world and make it kind of not a kind of an abstraction, but something to do with the worlds we live in. And although, you know, obviously, neither Wittgenstein nor Russell were phenomenologists by any stretch of the imagination. The intention, I think, was similar, that they wanted to come up with a philosophy which would help us understand the world, and better help us to communicate in that world. And that's where their kind of focus was. You know, how do we communicate our world to each other, such that, you know, we're not confused. So that we don't get misunderstood, so that we are representing, if you like, a common world, a shared world. And I think it's good to keep that in mind. These are not people just doing clever things with maths.
Yes.
These are people who are generally thinking, how can we use, you know, I mean, you know, as I'm sure you'll explore, I mean, Wittgenstein, for whatever reasons, got to the, you know, finished the Tractatus and thought, right, I've done it. That's it. I've answered philosophy now. We now have a tool which will allow us to explore the world and communicate effectively to other people, the ideas in our own heads. That's all that philosophy ever needs to do.
Yeah.
And now it's time to move on. I mean, do you think that's a reasonable assessment of their
intentions? I think so.
Intentions?
Absolutely right. I mean, they're coming at the beginning. It's definitely, they are definitely coming at philosophy with that kind of enlightenment. We need to find one answer. We need to find an essence here. We need to find a thing. But also, you have Wittgenstein who wants to be serious about philosophy. It's not a frivolous thing. It's like being an engineer for Wittgenstein. He sees philosophical problems as kind of things going wrong with a machine, and it's irritating to him. Yeah. So it was especially irritated by, you know, going to the philosophy department in Cambridge and hearing other people talk about philosophy, because it's like he said, it's like philosophical journalism, just like people talking, you know. And to him,
which is the stuff I like.
Yeah, him is like, you know, it's like it's his profession. But for Russell was definitely. Wittgenstein didn't like what Russell was doing, in the sense that Russell was trying to be popular. So he brought out, you know, simple books. He brought about the history of philosophy. He did make steps into making it kind of accessible to everyone. And Wittgenstein saw that as that you're not taking it seriously. If you're not going to, you know, it doesn't want to know you if you're not taking it seriously. You know, it's very important thing he's doing. But to go back to the Tractatus then. We can. It's difficult to sum it up, but we can do it a little bit. So, you know, Russell, Frege, they want to find the the structure of language and the structure of logic and the structure of language, and find the kind of essence. How does it work? And what they kept doing was with as seen with Vic, Russell, is kind of running up against language, trying to find something within language to point the essence of it. And what that does is create more language to describe, trying to find what language is. Yes. If you get what I mean.
Yes.
It's trying to catch the tail. A cat trying to catch his own tail.
Yeah. So what, that's a set of all sets, isn't it?
That's the one. Yeah.
It's a thing that can't talk about itself. I mean, that's an interesting thing because that crops up in different philosophical dispositions. And you find a similar sort of thing in Foucault, where Foucault says, the social sciences are an irrelevancy because you can't, human beings can't look at themselves. Human beings can't look at themselves objectively.
Yeah.
To ask human questions. So you can never look at yourself. I mean, you can see a reflection, but that's your face the wrong way around. You can never look at yourself directly in the face.
Yeah.
So one of the things that philosophy has always come up against is, we are, no matter how objective we try and be, we are always invested. It's human beings asking questions about human beings.
Yes.
And it's the human language trying to find ways of discussing the human language.
Yeah.
So it becomes like what philosophers call it, it's a kind of tautological thing. It's kind of it just goes around and around in circles if you're not careful, unless you find a jumping off point somewhere.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, without trying to get too technical about it, because the Tractatus is amazingly technical, and I still don't understand a third of it because I can't understand the kind of logical symbols in it. One day I hope to try to understand it, because for me, it's a work of beauty. The Tractatus is unlike any other philosophical thing I've ever read. It's so beautiful in its own way. But anyway, so what? Trying to find the essence of language using language is difficult. So what Wittgenstein does is he comes up with this idea of the picture theory. So the picture theory is a way to try to understand how language works. What is the link between our words we use and our reality? And how do we know the meaning of a word? And what the picturing theory does is it says that we picture things in our head of the world. And we then can take that language right up to the world and see a relationship between the two. And we can find meaning in both. So, you can say, in the Tractatus, it's just full of propositions. And we look at those propositions and in depth to see if they have sense. So for Wittgenstein, it's like, in a kind of modern way, taking a language and trying to make it fit into a computer program. What makes sense? What propositions have sense? And if they have sense, then they're a definite understanding of the world. That leads us then, if you're following so far.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Please ask questions, because this is like, if it doesn't make sense, then I'm not explaining it properly.
Well, one of the you might be able to put me right on this, but as I recall, one of the kind of one of the kind of moments for Wittgenstein as he was kind of pondering these ideas was an encounter with. Wasn't it some sort of encounter with a report on a traffic accident?
That's exactly right. Yeah,
is that right? And he said something along the lines of, "Oh, well, we have this now. When people are in court, they might have like a dramatic reconstruction using models, or photo, or illustrations, or whatever." So, Wittgenstein said it was fascinated by the fact that this traffic accident was described by creating a kind of a picture using model cars. And so on. And he said, "Oh, that picture created a picture, a larger, if you like, mental picture in the minds of the people in the courtroom, so they could kind of try and understand the event." And this is, as I understand, this is what prompted him to say, "Well, maybe that's what language does all the time. That I've got something in my head, and I want to get it into your head. And so what I do is I paint a picture in words, in the hope that that picture will resonate in your own head,
yes,
and make you and make you experience a thing that I'm experiencing in my head.
Yeah.
So if as we're saying to our audience here now, oh Danny, you know, cheers, what are you drinking? Then that's painting a picture in our in our listener's head of somebody called Danny, and they're not entirely sure who you are because they may not have seen you, but it's a picture of somebody with a drink in his hand, kind of perhaps holding it up in a particular way. What have you got going on there today then?
It's extra strength vodka.
Extra strength, is that extra strength isolationist vodka?
Yeah.
So people now, so we've said that, I've said, you know, cheers Danny. So now in people's heads, they are painting this picture of of you, whoever you are, with a drink. And the more accurate that picture, then the better the communication. Is that that the thing?
Yeah, so we have to remember what we're doing this for as well. We're basically trying to understand, if we can understand the structure of language, we can understand its relationship to the world. And that is fundamental for understanding our reality. We use our language to understand reality. So if we can get down the structure of language, that's the key to understanding our reality.
Right.
Yeah. So yes. we're trying to find. Yeah, I kind of neglected to mention that at the beginning. Yeah. So that's what they're. Yeah, that's what they're doing in this kind of analytic philosophy. So the picturing theory is a way of understanding language without trying to penetrate it. So before, philosophy was looking at objects. Always talk about objects. They always talk about the table, don't they? Because the table is all in front of us. What's the essence of the table? But for Wittgenstein, the essence of the table is not important. It's how the table is in reality. So the table sits on the floor, for example. The table's on the floor, and that is a thing that we can picture in our minds. A table in isolation, we could kind of picture it, but in our minds, it's floating in white space or something. It's always doing something. It's always somewhere. Yeah. So it's not the table itself. It's the what he calls state of affairs. So the state of affairs is kind of a collection of atomic facts, the chair and the floor. And so the picturing theory allows us to say, the way he explains it, it's like these three things are a record, an old vinyl record, a piece of sheet music, and someone singing a song. They're all the same song, but they're in different formats. So it's not the it's not the the song that's important that that links them, links the three. Well, that's the thing we can't really get at, but they're kind of representations of it. And so the Tractatus then works with that idea. You have to then take these states of affairs, the cat on the mat, the table on the floor, and then go out in the world, and then find he creates these kind of truth tables to find the kind of logic beneath the a proposition. Any proposition has this kind of matrix of truth and falseness.
That reminds us, interesting again, isn't it? Kind of, again, although you have to stress that, you know, these are not phenomenologists in any recognisable way. And yet again, the agenda seems to be the same, that we want to talk about not abstract essences in the way that a lot of philosophical ontology has been discussed in the past. What's the essence of a thing?
Yeah.
But people like you know, Russell and Wittgenstein were more concerned not with things, but with facts about the world.
Yes.
So it's kind of how a thing is in the world, rather than just some kind of abstract. This is a table, as you say. It's kind of how is this table in the world? It's, you know, it's on the floor. There's a teapot on it, so the teapot is on the table, which is on the floor.
Yes.
And those collections of facts are what's meaningful.
Yeah.
And language needs to be able to render those facts in some sort of picture way,
yes,
so that we can communicate facts about the world, which is why, you know, the world is everything that is the case.
Yes.
You know, things being, I'm guessing that's what he's getting at there, that the case is, you know, the world is just a collection of facts. It's not a collection of things, it's a collection of facts.
Yes.
About Yeah,
yes, so
right?
Facts.
I'm really impressed with myself.
Yes,
you do this for a living.
There's a danger when you get into this is trying to remember to bring it back to why we're doing this, you know.
Basically, it's just
getting back to the structure of language. So, understand the structure of language, we can then begin to, you know, sort out philosophy. But what we find is actually later is Russell is totally not kind of that new way of thinking, and the Vienna Circle are totally not that new way of thinking. But let's finish off the Tractatus a little bit.
Just finish off.
Just knock it off quickly. There's so much going on the Tractatus, but so we've got our kind of system of looking at propositions, and then going out in the world, and then looking at their if they make sense. Not that they can't be senseless. They need to make sense. For example, there isn't a dinosaur in this room with me.
Really?
It makes sense. I mean, it's not senseless.
No, I mean, normally if your son's there, then there's likely to be a dinosaur in the room somewhere.
Yeah.
Isn't he keen on dinosaurs? I thought he was keen on dinosaurs.
Yeah, he was.
He was. Sorry, I interrupted you.
In that way, there's lots of propositions that have sense, but not necessarily true. So something can be not true, but still be part of language. So what sits outside propositions that make sense? Nearly everything does. So any philosophical questions or philosophical arguments sit outside meaningful language. Anything to do with religion, anything to do with aesthetics,